Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Robert J. Sawyer, author of The Oppenheimer Alternative, which will be published June 2nd by Kazakh Science Fiction and Fantasy, an imprint of Ark Manor. Robert is one of the most renowned science fiction writers of our generation. I could simply introduce him as the winner of all three of the most prestigious awards in science fiction, the Hugo, the Nebula, and the Campbell, one of only eight authors who have accomplished this, plus like 20 other awards and as many or more novels, many classics. His work has been influential to the next generation of sci-fi authors, and his hard sci-fi approach to writing appeals to a much larger audience than one might expect. The Oppenheimer Alternative does lots of things for the reader. Robert reacquaints us, those who ever were acquainted, with the events of World War II giving rise to the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project, Los Alamos, of course, Robert Oppenheimer, but a cast of characters that is the entire panoply of scientists and Nobel Prize winners who helped to shape the understanding of our universe in the 20th century, from Einstein to my hero Richard Feynman, to Enrico Fermi, to Edward Teller, Hans Witte, Niels Bohr, Freeman Dyson, Kurt Gödel, many of the wives of these pioneers, and an even more esoteric cast, including Kennedy, Johnson, Truman, and even J. Edgar Hoover. Not only are these characters involved, but they are drawn in such a way as to give us insight into their actual character, their personalities, and their morals. Much of the book is true fact, but much is an alternative narrative of a world in which a disaster far greater than Edward Teller's obsession with the super, the hydrogen bomb, looms ahead for us, actually here in the present. So suffice it to say that you'll come away with more knowledge of the atom, fission, fusion, and the power that drives our sun and all of the stars that make up our firmament, as well as the infinitesimal universe that makes us, us. So with that, welcome, Robert, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Sam, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So today, we stand on the shoulders of these giants that you have written about. What was it that gave rise to your effort to flesh these characters out so well, in addition to the alternate future that you propose?
You know, most fiction, it has been said, is a redemption story of one form or another. And many years ago, I was a teenager and I watched The $6 Million Man, and there was an episode called The Last Kamikaze. And Steve Austin, this American hero, was explaining to a Japanese kamikaze pilot who had been living in the Philippines, unaware that World War II had ended. This was 1976, I guess, that I saw this episode. And Steve Austin, the American hero, said, "We dropped bombs on Japan. A lot of us wish that had never happened." That was the first time in my life that I heard anybody express actual regret about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the 75th anniversary of which is about to be upon us. So when I started looking into the fact that this is the 75th year and what all this meant, I found that almost everybody who had been involved with this project, the Manhattan Project, came to regret their involvement. Probably Albert Einstein, most of all, who was the man who started the Manhattan Project by signing a letter. He hadn't written it. It had been written by Leo Szilard. But he signed the letter to President FDR, Roosevelt at the time, saying, look, we got to get a jump on the rest of the world in building atomic bombs, especially on the Nazis. Turned out the Nazis weren't building one. Turned out that nobody would have built one if the United States hadn't. And we live in fear today because of the hubris, in a way, of these scientific geniuses who felt that if it can be done, it must be done. And then, oh my God, what have we let out of the bottle?
Well, so I have a list of questions, but when you talk, I think every time I'm going to go off on a sidebar. So, and here's the
first. As if the $6 million man wasn't enough.
Right. Well, here's a question that you just raised about the Nazis not having the bomb. You know, I've read two or three different books about Heisenberg whose Principle of Uncertainty is amazing, but whether or not he actually was working on the bomb or whether he was impeding the Germans on purpose in their attempts to produce one. What do you think?
Yeah, of course, there's the fascinating stage play about this particular issue, with Heisenberg's meeting with his mentor, Niels Bohr. And I honestly think that Heisenberg was throwing the game. I think a number of physicists have come to realize that. It's contentious because, of course, how much would you put in the record at the time you were misleading your bosses? But Heisenberg was a patriotic German, and there was nothing contradictory about being that, even through the Second World War. Perfectly reasonable to love your own country. That said, and this may have some resonances for some of your listeners today, you can love your country without loving the leadership or what it's doing currently on the world stage. He knew that there would be a post-war Germany, whether they were victors or not. He knew there would be one. And I do think he felt the world would be a better place if there was no Nazi-controlled atomic bomb. And, you know, this is one of my mantras in life is the world would be a better place if the brightest people in the world stopped being willing to make the things the stupidest people in the world wanted them to make. Instead of saying, oh yeah, as Oppenheimer did, that's a sweet problem. Why don't we see if we can unleash hell on the surface of the earth? Instead of saying, you know, I know you can't do it, President Roosevelt or Chancellor Hitler, and I ain't going to do it for you. So end of discussion. We might have had a much better world, much safer world if it had been that way. And I do think Heisenberg, within the confines of what you could get away with and still live in Nazi Germany and not be executed or sent to a camp, did as much as he could to impede the effort.
It's easier said than done, though, because these guys were so smart that it's really hard not to do what you want to do, and it leads to the wrong thing, but it's really hard not to.
100%. You give anybody a challenge. Give me as a writer a challenge. I wrote a previous series, and the whole challenge to me was an article that had been written about Helen Keller. A psychologist and philosopher had said, it's impossible for any of us to imagine what it was like to be Helen Keller in a pre-linguistic state. It's incapable, or we're incapable of imagining that. And I said, hold my beer, and wrote three books on that theme, right? Of course, you can't resist a challenge, but very few novels have actually hurt the world. And some, like, Uncle Tom's Cabin, have changed the world enormously. But actual scientific inventions, I think there is this old dichotomy. Do we, you know, is there anything good or evil in knowledge, and whether or not that's true? And a lot of scientists know there's no such thing as bad knowledge. There's only bad applications of knowledge. Well, maybe there are a few genies that should have been kept in the bottle.
Okay, well, let's get back on track and ask a question about hard science and something that many of our listeners may not know in terms of magnitudes. But since with so many of your characters are Nobel Prize winners,
yes,
let's talk a little bit about Nobel, and then the orders of magnitude that moved on from his day through to where we are today, and the Bomba, the 300.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, and the fascinating thing about Alfred Nobel is that he got to see his own obituary, which most of us never get to see, because his brother died and a paper accidentally published his obituary instead of his brother's. And it said the merchant of death has finally died, because he, of course, Nobel, had been famous for the invention of dynamite, of TNT. And he came to realize, oh my God, this is what I'm going to be remembered for. And he set about to give away almost all of his fortune to make the world a better place instead of a worse place, hence the endowment of the Nobel Prizes, including the Nobel Prize for Peace. The TNT and dynamite was nothing compared to the atom bomb. And the atom bomb, sad to say, was nothing compared to the hydrogen bomb. And Edward Teller, one of the characters you mentioned, who's a character in my book, a real physicist, didn't even want to trifle with the atomic bomb. He said, why destroy just the better part of a town when you can lay waste to continents? And he set out to build, and the reason we have hydrogen bombs today. Nobody makes atomic bombs except that they're used as triggers for hydrogen bombs, is because he said, no, let's make the biggest bang for the buck, including, and he even had planned out, I haven't mentioned it in the novel, but it's absolutely true, a series of stages of how you would deliver successively greater payload bombs. And his final one was listed as backyard. You don't have to deliver it anywhere. You just set it off and the whole world is destroyed. That was a real project for Edward Teller. It's mind-boggling to us. And yet the challenge, could you build a bomb big enough to wipe out humanity? Goes, like your skeleton behind you there who's doing the thinker pose. Let me think about that. I bet I can find a way.
Oh, that's like Einstein saying, oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Yes, which he says very famously, right? Leo Szilard shows up at Einstein's summer home, his cottage, and says, you know, I've been looking at your equations, and it kind of implies a chain reaction is possible that would continue indefinitely until fuel is exhausted and result in a big explosion. And Einstein said, of course, in German, but he said, I never thought of that, right? Your frame of mind has an enormous amount to do with what your blinders are. It doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum. It's what you think you're thinking about limits what you do think about. And Szilard, who was a very practical man, saw the practical application of what Einstein thought was simply of interest to physicists.
It's interesting, once again, going off track, when you said about we'll continue, the chain reaction will continue until the fuel runs out. Talk about those who thought there was like, you know, 5 or 10% chance that when they a trinity, it would essentially ignite the atmosphere and destroy the entire world.
That's right. 75 years ago, July 16th of 1945, the first ever atomic bomb was set off. Trinity test site, Alamogordo, New Mexico. And there were some thoughts based on the mathematics of it that it might set fire to the atmosphere. The whole atmosphere might combust. And these scientists weighed the odds and decided it's negligible. How much is negligible? 1 in 10 shot. And they went ahead and did it. And it's astonishing to us to think that our lives were in the hands of people who thought that was an acceptable risk to take. It was only actually after they recrunched the numbers and said, well, maybe it's only 1 in 100. But even 1 in 100, right? We're recording this right now, Sam, during the COVID-19 lockdown. Your chance of walking out right now and getting COVID is less than 1 in 100. And we're all, the whole planet, taking precautions. But these physicists said, you know, it's worth doing the experiment if the risk is only that amount. So, yeah, incredible. Hubris is a word that comes back over and over again when you talk about these guys. To think that without putting it to a plebiscite, without asking the president of the United States or the United Nations, which didn't even exist yet, but the League of Nations, hey, can we go ahead and try this? No. We'll just push the button and see. And if it blows up, well, at least we won't have to answer for our crime.
It is amazing. It reminds me of when Feynman was on the Challenger commission and, you know, NASA had said there's a 1 in 100,000 chance of the Challenger exploding, whereas the Gunthrop and I guess Lockheed basically said, no, it's more like 1 in 200, something like that. And that's Feynman, right, being the pragmatist that he was going, this is just like when he criticized the California textbooks. You know, this stuff isn't right.
Go ahead. You mentioned Richard P. Feynman, eventually a Nobel laureate. He's one of the characters, as you mentioned, in my novel. One of the joys of doing this, Sam, has been reality handed me a cast of characters so larger than life, so eccentric, so brilliant, that had I made them up, people would have said, oh, come on now, right? The brilliant physicist whose favorite bars were topless bars and had worked out strategically how to pick up women by ignoring them. I mean,
pick locks
as a hobby, and of course be a great bongo player. These characters were so compelling to write about. I had such a joy getting into their heads. Now, for many of them, Feynman didn't technically write a biography, but his reminiscences were written down and were published as Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and so forth. The other characters mostly did write autobiographies. General Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, for instance, Leo Szilard, and so forth, but not J. Robert Oppenheimer. And he's my main character. And the joy of that was no one had ever had been privy to his inner life, which, as you know, is the novelist's playground, right? TV and film, even stage plays, do the outer life of characters. The novelist is the one creative person who gets to write about what somebody is actually thinking. And that territory, how to reconcile Oppenheimer's often contradictory and hugely self-damaging personal actions with some kind of rationalization that must have been going on between those ears in that massive brain, was such a joy to get to try and puzzle out his psychology. Who knows? He's dead. Did I get it right or wrong? We won't know. His son is alive, Peter. I hope to hear from Peter at some point, whether or not he likes the way I assessed his father.
Well, it's interesting that you preface the chapters with a quote.
Yes.
And that shows dramatically the different ways that Oppenheimer was perceived, which leaves you, was he arrogant? Was he a horse's ass in some ways? Was he, the moment he looked at what he had done and said, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds, you know, was this a man who studied the Bhagavad Gita? You know, what kind of person was he? And you didn't have to invent any of that. That's right there for you to take.
Absolutely. And as you say, at every chapter, there are 50 odd chapters in the book, there's an epigraph, which is a real life quotation from somebody famous. And many of them are their reflections on the character of Oppenheimer, who was, we didn't use the word back then in Oppie's day, we use it today all the time, polarizing. He was a polarizing figure. You loved him or you hated him. As Enrico Fermi said when the McCarthy-esque hearings came after Oppenheimer, too bad they didn't go after a nice guy like Bethe, like Hans Bethe. Now we all have to be on Oppenheimer's side, right? But other people would have literally taken a bullet for that guy who just loved and adored him. And it's so fascinating to write a character that inspired such loyalty and such passionate hatred from all kinds of people, from other scientists and from military folks. Some military guys loved him. Groves never wavered in his absolute faith in this guy over an entire lifetime, whereas other military people just despised him. And as Truman said, I never want to see that son of a bitch in this office ever again, you know?
Yes, I have blood on my hand. He takes out his handkerchief. The other interesting thing is how you portrayed Szilard as a kind of Falstaff, especially like in his meeting with Wernher von Braun, and, you know, the diametrically different physiques of the two men. And I remember when I was a kid, Wernher von Braun was like my hero until I started realizing Operation Paperclip, and I'm Jewish, and, yes. And started realizing the Operation Paperclip and what he actually did. But yeah, he was my hero. He looked like the all-American kind of guy. And you know, he never really wanted to go to the moon. He wanted to go to Mars. And that's the cool thing.
Well, and I have that great quote, of course, you know, he said, he titled a book, "I aim for the stars." And Mort Saul, the great comedian, said, "But sometimes he hits London." Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. A Nazi, wore a Nazi uniform, supervised or certainly was the aware of the horrific slave labor conditions at the rocketry plant that he was in charge of. And the complicit nature of the government of the United States and in the UK with other people of saying, we know, you know, you were horrible, you were monstrous, you were a Nazi, but you've got info we can use. And so all sins forgiven, come become Wernher von Braun. If his name had been Ivan Demjanjuk, would have spent the rest of his life in hearings, investigating, and finally being deported and blah, blah, blah. But instead, he said, "Oh, we'll make you head of the Apollo Saturn space program. You'll get to have unlimited funds to realize your childhood dream of putting a man on the moon because you're the guy who can do it, despite all of your personal failings and despite your history of being a Nazi." And Leo Szilard, what a character. Falstaff is a perfect comparison that you just made there, Sam. He's not as well known to the general public as Einstein, for instance, or Niels Bohr, or of course, Oppenheimer, or Edward Teller. But such a fascinating character, because his principal role in life was being a gadfly. He would show up and be a catalyst at exactly the right moment, the catalyst for the research that led to nuclear fission, the catalyst for the creation of the Manhattan Project, the catalyst for organizing scientists to start vocalizing their opposition to dropping bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki or whatever targets were going to be bombed in Japan. The catalyst for starting a peace movement after World War II. What an amazing character. I just love the guy.
It's funny how in this conversation he's laughing at the concept of, well, you would need one stage, then a second stage, then a third stage. And then you think about it and you look at the Saturn V, and what an incredible cost inefficient way. And then that reminds me of, I always think about Elon Musk, because he's done more in 5 years, in my opinion. And yes, he might be a jackass too, but he's done more in 5 years than NASA has done in 70. He lands boosters on a launching
on a
pad,
barge in the ocean,
and he calls them, you know, "Of course I still love you," or "Mrs. Stevens." But the thing about it is that neither the Russians nor us were always landing in water. We're landing on the steps, and he just brings them back down, including catching the fairings. Isn't it amazing to you that the single person, the people who, like Steve Jobs, who make a dent in the universe?
That's right. This is the interesting change from Oppenheimer's day. In Oppenheimer's day, there were no billionaire scientists, and there were no patrons of the sciences the way we have today. There were billionaire industrialists, of course, Carnegie and so forth, and people who followed in that phase. But what we have now is people who really are interested in science for science's sake, and space because they grew up watching Star Trek and watching Apollo, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and so forth, who want Branson, who runs Virgin, Richard Branson, these guys have billions and can bypass the government bureaucracy. When Wernher von Braun was brought to America, his only possibility of doing Apollo was with a government bureaucracy. There was no Jeff Bezos who say, "Come to me in Seattle," or Elon Musk who say, "Come to me over here and we'll give you whatever it takes. Make my dream come true with my money and your genius will do it." So the cutting out of the bureaucratic middleman, we've seen the difference there. Every bureaucracy exists with two goals in mind. One, to perpetuate its existence. No bureaucracy has ever come into existence, even the Tennessee Valley Authority or any of the World War II special bureaucracies, with any intention of ever folding up their tent and going home. And number two, increasing the size of the bureaucracy, because that's how you measure your importance to the government. That's why it took forever to get from, well, 1972, the last person to walk on the moon. My God, 1972, no one has gone more than 500 kilometers from Earth since 1972. You can drive as far, if you could drive straight up, you can do it in 5 hours, as far as we can go, in your car. And it doesn't even have to be one of Elon Musk's Teslas. It can be any car. And it'll go farther than we've gone because of bureaucracy. So, yeah, we're seeing a whole new age. And yet, I'm a science fiction writer. It was the age that Robert Heinlein and all the science fiction writers predicted, which would be, it'd be crazy scientists with a dream doing it on their own, despite the government. That seems to be where we are right now.
Yeah, it's just the idea that you build these space shuttles that essentially have no purpose. They go up and then they come down. Other than the space station, I don't know what they would be doing. And now we hitch rides.
I mean, I love the one thing I love about the International Space Station is that it is the International Space Station. We got to the moon because Kennedy and Khrushchev and successors were trying to one-up each other, right? See who could do it first. After Sputnik had sort of thrown down the gauntlet, the Soviets had said, we're better at science than anybody in the world, America had to trump that. Well, we'll go to the moon first. But now we go up and down in good old Soyuz capsules, which the Soviets have been using since the 60s, to a space station where the core modules were built by the United States and the European Space Agency, with a remote manipulator arm that was built by my country, Canada. It's lovely to see that it no longer is some kind of macho contest between countries, but the shared heritage of the whole human race. I love that.
If we move back down, going back to the book, I know we're trying to sell your book. If we move back down to that, I was heartened, and this is the last time we'll talk about Feynman. I was heartened that you decided to include the posthumous letter to Arlene the way you did.
Oh my God. It's Feynman's wife died, and she died of tuberculosis while he was at Los Alamos. One of the reasons he became an expert at defeating security systems is so that A, he could go visit his dying wife, and B, so they could communicate freely despite the censorship that was going on of communication with scientists at Los Alamos. But she did die. And for all of his subsequent playing around with women, she, Arlene, had been the love of his life, his soulmate. And he wrote this just heart-wrenching letter to her saying, you know, I know you want me to be happy. I know you want me to find someone else. I know you are applauding every attempt I make. But they're all, and he uses their ashes, every woman I meet compared to you. And he sends this letter, or writes this letter, and he says in the PS, forgive me for not writing sooner, but I didn't have your address because she's gone. And I build a scene around that where I interpolate a stanza. It's because it's poetic. A stanza at a time from that great letter, which really he did write, with his inner life and what's going on around him. It's one of my favorite chapters in the book. You know, this guy who had a reputation for being a bit bawdy and a bit rambunctious, his soulmate was never replaced. And that kind of transcendental love, we should all be so lucky to find at some point in our life.
And the other way you do it in the book too, where you shift to the spiritual in a sense, is when you, from time to time, quote from the Bhagavad Gita because of Oppenheimer's familiarity with it, and it comes to mind so many times in his life, and his wife gets sick of it.
That's right. Oh, absolutely. Yes. And Oppenheimer, I mean, he was not just a polymath, he was a polyglot. He spoke a lot of languages, but he learned Sanskrit specifically so he could read the Gita in the original, the Bhagavad Gita. And the most famous line in the world from the Bhagavad Gita is Oppenheimer's own translation of a stanza from the Gita, where Vishnu, in the multi-armed form, Vishnu has come to visit the prince, who is reluctant to do his duty, and says unto him, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds," which is the form Vishnu. And that line, everybody knows that line because Oppenheimer famously thought it and then told Edward R. Murrow on CBS that that's what he was thinking at the time of the atomic bomb going off. But Oppenheimer went back repeatedly to this Hindu sacred text. We often talk about, you know, is there a conflict between science and religion? And Oppenheimer was raised Jewish, but in a very secular environment at the Ethical Culture School in New York. But he found a lot of comfort, not in Jewish scripture, not in Christian scripture, but he turned to Hindu mysticism. And the Gita was extraordinarily important to him. And that line, "Now I'm become death, the destroyer of worlds," I riff on in my novel, The Oppenheimer Alternative. He gets an opportunity to turn that around, he and his colleagues, in hopes of being able to say, "Now we are become life, the saviors of our world."
One of the things that I find fascinating in my life, and perhaps in yours as well, is the way that the Dalai Lama meets with quantum physicists every year.
Yes.
And each time he meets, they become closer and closer together in their interpretation of how the universe works. Isn't that fascinating?
It is fascinating. And, you know, it's funny, my literary agent is also the Dalai Lama's literary agent.
Really?
So I will never be his most famous client because it represents the Dalai Lama. But this whole notion, which really all of these scientist characters that I was writing about were there at the transition from classical physics to the birth of quantum theory to our realization that reality is not concrete and is not what it seems to our senses. And so it actually isn't that bizarre when you reflect upon it, that real cutting edge physics starting at the dawn of the previous century with quantum theory has really put into fundamental conflict our notions of, if I can touch a physical object, if I can lift my drink up here, it must have physical substantiality, it exists in only one form. If I drink it, it changes in a way that's predictable in a Newtonian sense. The volume goes down in the bottle, goes up in my belly. No, none of that is true. Not a word of what I just said about reality turns out to be true. And so great thinkers like the Dalai Lama and great physicists have all had to meet on the middle ground of philosophy. And in that, they find they've got way more in common, if they have open minds on both sides, than they ever would have thought of, let's say, in the 19th century, when it was clear that there was a dichotomy between the two.
It's funny because it also reminds me of, first of all, I can't help but go back to Feynman, the idea of time running backwards.
Yes.
Which is a posit of the book. Well, I don't want to give away spoilers.
Right? No spoilers.
Yeah. So, but Feynman does come up with that. And it's interesting because you talk about the Van Allen radiation belts and how essentially that's why we're here. And there's so many things like that. The idea of being in the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah.
Just the fact that ice doesn't sink.
That's right.
Yeah.
Every other substance, when you take it from liquid to make it solid, becomes denser. And if it's denser, it's heavier per unit volume and it sinks. Every other substance except water. Water expands when it freezes. We've all seen sidewalks that have buckled because of that. But that's why ice floats. And we're so used to it, we don't stop to think, that's a miracle that it floats. Because that's what allowed life to develop on our planet. We all are pretty much convinced that life began in the seas, not on land. It began on the bottom of the seas, not floating around. And if water froze from the bottom up, ecosystems couldn't survive. Instead, it freezes and floats on the surface, and we still have very vibrant ecosystems. I live in Canada, where we're very protective of our northern ecosystem, where we have, you know, a coat of ice, but underneath there's fish, there's sea lions, there's polar bears swimming. It's miraculous. You never would have predicted it. And it's one of those astonishing realities that gives rise to us. The Van Allen radiation belts, if they weren't there, if we didn't have this magnetic field deflecting or capturing so much of the radiation from our sun, we also never could have come into existence. Mars has nothing remotely like our Van Allen radiation belts, and therefore probably its surface is sterilized better than your medical professional sterilizes instruments between uses. It's sterilized by a constant onslaught of radiation that unimpeded hits the surface on Mars, but is deflected and gives us, again, here in Canada, these gorgeous auroral displays are because of the Van Allen belts.
Let's see if I can use my train of thought, if I can remember, to get back to the book. Let's see. So if you think about the strong anthropic product placement, if you think back to the strong anthropic principle and the idea the only reason when we can observe anything is because we're here, the only reason we're here is because of all these things. So that goes back to the fact that you talk about the, well, again, without giving away anything, the idea that, well, let's talk about Heisenberg and Schrodinger, who you bring up, and the idea by observing something, you actually change the thing that's being observed. But tell the two jokes, the Einstein joke and the Heisenberg joke about, there's two jokes you put in the book right next to each other.
Right. Right. Oh, my God. All right.
The bus, Einstein and the bus.
Instead of the train. Einstein gets on it's actually a train.
Train,
and
right.
He says to the conductor, does Luxembourg stop at this train? As opposed to, does this train stop in Luxembourg? Because it's all relative, right? Either frame of reference, either the train is moving and Luxembourg is stationary, or Luxembourg is moving and the train is stationary, are equally valid. And then Heisenberg, whose uncertainty principle says that the better you know something's velocity, the less precisely you know its location. And so he's tooling down a motorway and gets pulled over. And the cop says to him, do you know how fast you were going? He says, no, but I know where I am. And then Schrodinger is also in the car. And then, of course, is the famous Schrodinger's cat experiment, where until you look in a box where there's a cat and a vial of cyanide that has a 50-50 chance of having broken open and killed the cat, until you look, the cat is neither dead or alive. And so the cop pulls him over and says, well, I'm going to have a look in your trunk. And he says, hey, do you know you have a dead cat back here? And Schrodinger calls out, well, we do now. And he calls him a name. We do now.
Yes.
Thanks, buddy.
Those, and I hadn't heard either of those jokes.
Are great, right? Physics jokes.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of cyanide, were they really given? These guys?
So in the novel, I have all sorts of precautions being taken, as they really were, lest Oppenheimer be kidnapped, because he had all the secrets of the atomic bomb. And we know ultimately that's how the other side, the Soviets, got the atomic bomb, was by espionage at Los Alamos. Klaus Fuchs is the famous character involved with that. So I posited in the novel, there's no historic record that Oppenheimer and Groves and the other senior scientists were given cyanide pills to carry with them, capsules, in case they were captured. That's one little bit of invention that I have in the novel. But it resonates because Oppenheimer did famously, when he was a young man, try to poison his tutor at Cambridge by coating an apple he left on the teacher's desk, the very fruit of knowledge, coated in cyanide to kill the guy, apparently because the guy had rebuffed Oppenheimer's clumsy advances. Oppenheimer was probably bisexual in inclination, if not ever actualized indeed, given the times. So I don't know for a fact, but it's plausible in that so many people were issued these suicide pills during World War II. To be better to be dead than to be tortured and then be killed anyways.
If you had, well, so, okay, I can say this because it's been in some of the reviews. So with regard to the Orion Project.
Yes.
If you had, say, shaped charges and there was a shock absorber and such in a plate, is something actually like that conceivable in your mind?
Yes.
How? Yeah,
so Project Orion was an attempt to build an atomic bomb-propelled spacecraft. And it was actually something the United States government issued development contracts through to General Atomics. And Freeman Dyson was one of the scientists involved with that. And the idea was pretty straightforward. You have a rocket filled with little suitcase-sized atomic bombs. And you drop them. Of course, rockets go up. You drop them out the back of the rocket through a toroidal or donut-shaped plate. Plate has a little hole in the center. That's the hole of the donut for the bomb to drop through. And then you explode the bomb and the shock wave hits the plate and pushes the rocket out. Boom, boom, boom. And of course it would be very much a jerk, 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 jerk kind of movement up unless you had a complex system of carefully timed shock absorbers so that the plate is jerking, but the people in the cabin aren't jerking. And there, you can go onto YouTube and just put Project Orion. You can see the Project Putt-Putt, it was called.
Oh, yeah.
P-U-T-T test, which was really done with just conventional charges, not atomic bombs, to launch a little rocket that worked exactly by that technique. And it worked just fine. This would have worked. We abandoned it because the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty in the early 60s outlawed any explosion by any nation of atomic weapons in space. But it really probably would have worked and would have been capable of sustained acceleration. Part of the problem right now is when we go from Earth to Mars, we mostly just coast, right? We get into orbit, fire our engines once, and then we coast instead of accelerating all the way to the halfway point, turning around and then decelerating the other half, so that the voyage takes 8 months to a year and a half, depending on where you do it in Mars's orbit, whereas we could do it in a matter of weeks if we did it with a constantly accelerating nuclear pulse rocket. Project Orion absolutely figures in my plot. It really existed. It was the first time ever that a scientific project was killed because of a United Nations declaration. And it was collateral damage. It was never intended to be killed, but it was. You can't let off nuclear bombs in space. Thank God. I mean, despite Trump's Space Force fantasies, thank God that we've agreed as a civilization that we're not going to take those weapons into space.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Don't start me on Trump, because then you won't get a chance to speak anymore at all. So, okay, we'll leave that be. You mentioned his name, and if you mention his name, you may find that the rest of this interview is useless to you. So I will not go any further.
All right.
With that.
All right.
The other thing that they find out, which would make Project Orion essentially useless, is the fact that because Mars has no magnetic, electromagnetic belts around it, and that, you know, so Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. And Mars has no atmosphere, and this figures into your book too. Mars has no atmosphere, it has no protection against radiation. So what do you do? And as I think Oppenheimer's wife says, yes she does.
Kitty.
Kitty says, you know, what are you going to do when you get there? You're going to just have to be in little pods, and that's as far as you can go. And she's right.
Yeah, you know, Mars has a very negligible atmosphere, but it does have a 1% density of our atmosphere. It's all carbon dioxide. It's pretty useless. It's the new Everest. You know, Elon Musk is essentially Edmund Hillary in this. Why go to Mars? Because it's there. But even Edmund Hillary never said, I don't think I'll build myself a little house up here. Kind of nice, right? You need oxygen. You can't survive. And Everest, by the way, the summit of Everest is 100 times more hospitable to human life than is the surface of Mars, Because on the summit of Everest, okay, you're up pretty high. You're still protected by the ozone layer, the Van Allen belts. There's still some air to breathe up there. It's not like Everest pokes out of our atmosphere into vacuum. It's got to be simply that because it's there. In some sense, it's the same reason we went to the moon. The moon is completely inhospitable, right? No atmosphere, no protection from radiation, and really nothing to do there, right? You know, at least Mars has some very interesting geography. It has the highest volcano in the solar system, the deepest canyon in the solar system. There's some fun things to see, sights to see on Mars. But why we would want to live on Mars? I'm a science fiction writer, and I don't see it myself as being a particularly attractive alternative.
I know. Even when I read Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars.
Yes, by my great friend Kim Stanley Robinson.
Yeah, even when I read that, I still had to take it with a grain of salt.
Right.
I mean, and, you know.
And what Stan does in that trilogy is he says right off the bat, Mars is completely unsuitable for human life. And he also, it's interesting because we don't want to go too off a topic here, but Stan is also a huge conservationist. And yet, the thing they do is the thing we decry now, which is go into a pristine natural landscape and remake it for humans, right? You know, if we had it to do over, would we really have taken Las Vegas? Would we have taken the Nevada desert and turned it into this mecca of decadent capitalism, right? That's what basically Red Mars is all about. Let's take the pristine desert of Mars and turn it into something that it never was in nature.
Speaking of which, was the term terraforming really coined by
the great science fiction writer Jack Williamson in New Mexico, very near where the Trinity bomb was set off. He coined that term, and he also coined a term which we don't use, but I think is beautifully poetic. Instead of antimatter, he coined a term for it before we gave it that official name, contraterrene matter, right? Which is opposite of dirt, opposite of Earth. Contraterrene, which is beautiful. Jack Williamson, I had the great privilege of meeting him before he passed away. He wrote science fiction and published it professionally in 8 decades of life. Wow. Like in 8 decades, he was active. He lived into his 90s.
I like when terms that are coined by science fiction become general parlance, like the Big Bang.
Well, and the most important one here is the atomic bomb, the atom bomb.
Right.
Right. Yeah. H.G. Wells coined that. And one of the many things about Leo Szilard, who's the character of my novel, is that Szilard was friends with Wells. Szilard went and became Wells's agent for translation rights in Europe. So the reason that there were foreign editions of Time Machine and War of the Worlds and so forth in the middle of the century was because Leo Szilard sold the publishing rights on H.G. Wells's behalf. But yes, the atomic bomb, that's Herbert George Wells gave us that term and envisioned it. He didn't know how it would work. It was Szilard who figured out how it would work. He just knew that locked in the atom, there had to be an enormous amount of energy. He didn't have the training. He was a historian by training, H.G. Wells. Those people probably have forgotten, but that's what he made his living as, was being a historian. Astonishing prescience on his part.
Yes. Owning an independent bookstore as I do, I had beautiful copies of the fortnightly released episodes of Outline of History, which were basically meant for kids.
That's
and
right.
It was like 2 shillings. And it was in a beautiful slipcase, and I sold it, which the problem is you can't be a book collector and a bookseller at the same time.
I have many a friend who is in your boat. You know, one of my favorite novels and favorite movies is The Maltese Falcon, Dashiell Hammett.
And you bring it up in the book.
And I bring it up because it's relevant in the book, because Fat Man is named for the character that Sidney Greenstreet played in the movie, Casper Gutman. And initially, the Thin Man, who is named for another noir hero, and ultimately the design was changed and ended up being Little Boy. But in The Maltese Falcon, when Casper Gutman, the fat man, is explaining about the provenance of the falcon, he says, "This is history, Mr. Spade, not Mr. Wells's history." but history nonetheless, by which he means Herbert George Wells, H.G. Wells, because in the time that Hammett was writing and the time that Maltese Falcon was set, that's what Wells was known worldwide for, was for history. His science fiction novels are the things we remember him for today, but he was the leading popular historian, the Shelby Foote, let's say, of his era.
One of the things I found fascinating is that that Percival Lowell's idea of canals on Mars was actually still believed until the 20th century. And then when Wernher von Braun brings in those photographs of Mars,
yes,
and disproves that. So we really believe that in the 30s and the 20s?
Absolutely. It was always contentious because no two observers tended to see the same thing. And you would go years and years between good observations of Mars being possible so that, you'd say, well, I saw this. I want to see if it's there again. And you have to wait, for the next opposition to see it. But yes, the official United States Air Force map up until 1962 showed canals on the surface of Mars. It wasn't until 65 when Mariner 4, the first spacecraft to actually take what we would consider incredibly low resolution photos by today's standards, but took photos of the surface of Mars, that we learned once and for all that it did not have canals. Now, we knew that whatever lines we were seeing on the surface of Mars, kind of crisscrossing it, couldn't be just canals, because the smallest detail we could make out in our telescopes would be about 100 miles wide on the surface of Mars, the telescopes that existed at that time. But the idea that they might be narrow canals with wide green belts, just like the Nile has, seemed quite plausible until the early 1960s. We still were toying with the notion that there might be life on Mars. It was also that same Mariner 4, by the way, that discovered that Mars had no magnetic field to speak of, and that meant no Van Allen belts, and that meant that it would be pelted with surface radiation. It was probably the most tragic photo in the history of science, was that photo that unambiguously shows the surface of Mars to be as barren as the surface of the moon. It shattered dreams that had haunted humanity since our remote Pleistocene ancestors had first looked up and noticed that one of the objects in the night sky was the color of blood, the color of life, and that it moved independently of the background stars. Oh my God. And our imaginations ran rampant until they couldn't anymore.
I did a science project on Mariner 4 when I was a kid.
Oh yeah.
I got an honorable mention, which, unlike you, is the only award I've ever gotten in my life.
I've been lucky as far as awards are concerned, but the real reward for any writer is satisfied readers. It's the only thing that really matters in the end.
Oh, that reminds me. So these books no longer are your firstborns, but they are kind of like your children. When you let them out into the world, to me, it's a question of, are you happy to have your reader interpret things perhaps differently than you had? Are you willing to let your reader give full rein to his own imagination? Does that bother you, or are you happy about that?
So it's funny, because we always hear in arguments about new media, the buzzword in new media is also always interactivity. Fiction writing has always been interactive. It has always been a collaboration between the writer and the reader. And that collaboration makes a different vision, a different experience for every reader. If I write, the most beautiful woman in the world walked into the room, who you picture could be anybody from a goth punk rocker filled with piercings and tattoos to a classic, blonde beauty, or a classic Ethiopian beauty. Whatever you picture is your collaboration with me. And in fact, it behooves us, when we're saying something like that, to not get too specific. If I want you to see your own vision, the more that I specify details that might be contrary to how you envision what great beauty might be, the less effective I've become as a writer for you. Now, for things that are value neutral, I describe a house, I describe a piece of furniture, somebody's clothes, that's perfectly fine. but the collaboration is so wonderful. And it's why everybody says, oh, you know, they did make a TV series out of one of my books. And when are they going to make a movie out of this? Flash forward on ABC, Sir Joseph Fiennes. But the reality is, once somebody makes a movie, it's fixed in a permanent form beyond the way it is on the printed page. Is it Harrison Ford or Tom Selleck who is starring in the film as Oppenheimer, let's say? Is it, you know, does Oppenheimer's house have green walls or blue walls? It's been decided by somebody else for you. I much prefer, in fact, that most of my favorite novels, setting aside my own, where I like The Money, most of my favorite novels have never been filmed, and that's perfectly fine. It allows them to be Schrodingerian. It allows them to be indeterminate until an observer opens the book and collapses reality as it is according to his or her version of how it should unfold.
That's true. And unfortunately for Philip K. Dick, so many of them have been turned into movies.
That's right.
For most of them, except for Blade Runner, which I think does justice to his books. You know, it's anyway, I'm going off on tangent again. There is one thing I want to talk to you about that I will veil in secrecy because it's a gigantic spoiler and only you and I will know and not the listener of this podcast. In the last chapter, when a certain thing happens and a certain visit takes place to attempt to stop something from happening, I was thinking, well, maybe that's why it happened, because it was such an incredible thing to be presented with, that maybe that was, but you didn't mean it that way, I don't think. Or did it ever occur to you?
So it did, of course. I mean, I'm a science fiction writer, and the thing we're talking about obliquely, which we will not give away here, is something that our great man H.G. Wells was pivotal in the invention of, and B is something that we've played with, me and my colleagues, for now. H.G. Wells invented it in 1895 is when Time Machine came out. So we've had 125 years of playing around with notions of time in physics and, Feynman and Gödel and so forth, and Einstein. All the physics of time was something that fascinated them. So, yeah, there's multiple ways to interpret the ending of my novel, and that's perfectly fine.
Just like Ray Bradbury's short story that you also include in your novel, Stepping on a Butterfly.
A Sound of Thunder, the Bradbury story. That's right. And, Bradbury was so prescient in recognizing what we now come to call chaos theory. Before it had a name, we still call it in the lay parlance the butterfly effect. But it comes from way before anybody talked about it in terms of a butterfly beating its wings in Toronto today, causing a storm tomorrow in Shanghai. Bradbury said, if you step on a butterfly 65 million years ago, that's all it takes to change everything. He was absolutely right.
And he ends up with Trump.
We got to go back and step on butterflies and cockroaches and inchworms and just keep stomping our feet until we get back to sanity.
Okay, why don't we end there before I actually go off on a rant? Because we've been talking an hour, and I really appreciate you taking up your valuable time doing that. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I could go on.
Well, thank you, Sam.
Listening to you for days. But this has been a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to talking to you again.
I loved it. Thank you, Sam. My pleasure. Okay. Take care, my friend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.